What's a regular gas price to you?
$1.65 a gallon.
Looking at the impacts of inflation in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 11th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes, filling in for Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans embrace the Black Lives Matter movement.
When we bleed, we all going to bleed the same color blood, so we need to come together and love one another.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Legislators return to Juneau today for the fifth special session since last summer, and lawmakers were greeted by a group of 20 protesters who want them to close the state's budget shortfall.
Act now! Pass the fiscal plan! Act now! Pass the fiscal plan!
But it's not clear if there are enough votes in the House to pass a bill that restructures permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. And several proposals to raise taxes on industries or introduce a new state income or sales tax may have even less support. The legislature also may not be able to muster the three-quarter majority needed to overturn Governor Bill Walker's veto of half this year's permanent fund dividend money. The veto essentially cuts PFDs in half. Walker says the House should follow the steps of the Senate and pass the permanent fund legislation. He notes that he's taken the unpopular steps of cutting PFDs and delaying oil and gas tax credits.
As a result of that, I expect them to come back and finish up the what I would call the lighter lifting associated with fixing Alaska's fiscal situation.
The House took a long break this afternoon as members of the Republican-led majority met to decide next steps. The Senate will meet again on Friday. In the meantime, Alaskans are already starting to feel the effects of state budget cuts, from shorter court hours to last-minute local budget negotiations. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
Friday afternoons used to be busy times for court-appointed advocates for children, but not anymore. Starting on July 1st, state courts began closing on Fridays at noon to save money. Margie McWilliams is an advocate who works in Juneau.
It impacts the children I advocate for just because they're children, and it slows down the resolution of issues in their cases. So from my perspective, it's really making a difficult problem even worse.
McWilliams' clients are among those impacted by the more than $800 million in cuts to the state operating budget. But they aren't the only ones. Department of Corrections employees and inmates will be reshuffled when one of the facilities closes. Drivers could be in for rough times when some Department of Transportation maintenance stations are shuttered, delaying repairs and causing roads to deteriorate faster. Live near a low traffic road? Those might be impassable for several days if there are back-to-back snowstorms. And Walker's vetoes reduce the Child Support Services Division by $500,000, so the division will close its Juneau and Wasilla field offices. State fiscal policy analyst Brian Fechter says this is similar to other cuts that reduce the number of staff positions and thus government's ability to provide services.
And a lot of it just goes back to longer lines and greater backlogs. For instance, the Child Support Services veto, that's less capacity in their division, potentially longer wait times for any services they provide to people.
On the bright side, the budget cuts aren't expected to lead to many pink slips for state workers. While state officials project that the budget will lead to 309 fewer positions, Fechter says the number of layoffs will be much lower.
It's our philosophy to avoid a pink slip layoff wherever possible.
Instead, the Walker administration will aim to leave vacant positions unfilled and give those workers whose positions are eliminated enough notice for them to find new jobs. But that's just state government jobs. The cuts will also ripple through Alaska's private economy. A study by the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research says $235 million in cuts to state agency budgets could cost, directly and indirectly, more than 2,000 jobs statewide. Add in Walker's veto of half the money for the permanent fund dividend, and more than 4,000 jobs could be lost. But study author economist Gunnar Knapp says pointing out the negative consequences of the dividend reductions and budget cuts isn't enough. Knapp says critics of the cuts must consider the alternatives.
The question is not, what don't you like? The question is, well, what would you do? And that is the discussion we're eventually going to have to get to.
That's the discussion the legislature is supposed to have during the newest special session this month. They may be considering new tax packages and other ways to pay for state government. But in the meantime, local governments are scrambling to figure out their own unexpected budget gaps caused by the state cuts. Matanuskas Susitna Borough Mayor Vern Halter says the loss of more than $5 million in state school debt reimbursement will be a challenge to make up.
I am totally disappointed in Juneau, period. They cannot seem to do their business in a good fashion and then pass it on to municipalities and boroughs is what they're doing.
MatSU isn't the only borough struggling with this question. Communities across the state are trying to figure out how to cover the $30 million in school debt reimbursement they no longer have covered. With help from Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer, I'm Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau.
Democrat Steve Lindbeck is running a serious campaign against Alaska Congressman Don Young, to judge by the money, anyway. Lindbeck announced that he'd raised more than $400,000 in the prior 3 months. His campaign says more than 80% of that total comes from Alaskans. Lindbeck is a former general manager of Alaska Public Media and a former director of the Alaska Humanities Forum. This was Lindbeck's first fundraising quarter since he filed to run for Young's seat. He's already raised more than any other Young challenger since Ethan Berkowitz ran for Congress in 2008. Young announced that he's raised just under $135,000 over the same 3 months. Still, Young has been at it much longer. He says he's got $640,000 in cash on hand, nearly double what Lindbeck has in the bank after expenses. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists puzzle through the mystery of unusual whale strandings.
Even if you get to a whale, it's a lot of work to get down to bone like skull and spine.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
As oil prices have dropped and the state has struggled to pay its bills, Alaskans are seeing one benefit. The cost of living in Anchorage increased by the smallest amount in nearly three decades. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney reports low gas prices have a powerful effect on inflation in the state.
At a Tesoro near downtown Juneau, Tim Young makes a quick stop to put a few dollars worth of gas in his SUV. He says when he pays less to fill up his tank, it makes it easier to afford other essentials like food and rent.
When it goes down, it helps tremendously.
The price on this day, $2.78. Damian Thorne pulls up in a Jeep Liberty, which he describes as getting less than stellar gas mileage.
Where I got to fill it up at least two times a week and spending about $50 every time.
When gas prices dropped, Thorne says he and his wife noticed the extra money in their monthly budget, but he's not sure he'd trade higher energy prices and a balanced state budget for the money he saves when gas is cheap.
Yeah, I would just rather, you know, have just regular gas prices, you know, just.
What's a regular gas price to you?
$1.65 a gallon.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Down south, Ohio, you know, they got a dollar something a gallon down there.
Still, Thorne says a high price at the pump wouldn't stop him from buying gas, just like the high cost of living in Alaska wouldn't stop him from living in Juneau.
It's gas, so we need it. So it's, you know, I'm going to get it if it's $4 a gallon or, you know, because I got to get around. And so it's just, yeah, supply and demand.
Alyssa Rodriguez is an economist with the state's Department of Labor. She says the average cost of living, that's the amount of money it takes for Alaskans to buy milk or put fuel in their cars and pay rent or for health care, still went up last year. But that increase was slowed significantly by a 10% decline in energy prices in Anchorage in 2015.
And because energy factors into other things that we spend our money on, and one big piece is transportation, it brought the price of transportation down, and we spend a lot of our income on transportation.
Anchorage is the only city in the state where inflation is measured. Last year, its inflation rate went up 0.5%, according to the Department of Labor data. That's the lowest recorded increase in 27 years. This isn't the first time that energy prices have dropped. Rodriguez says they've been dropping for the last 4 years, though last year's was the largest drop in nearly a decade. And in Alaska's off-the-road system communities, energy costs dropped, but they're still extreme.
It might have one effect on Anchorage, but when you look at a place like Arctic Village or something that has to have all of their fuel flown in, obviously that cost is going to be magnified because you have additional costs for the fuel just to get your fuel to you.
In Arctic Village, residents are paying $10 a gallon at the pump. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Alaskans joined the wave of national protests this weekend after police shot and killed two more black men in Minnesota and Louisiana. More than 300 people gathered in Midtown Anchorage on Friday evening to drive home the message that black lives matter. But unlike protests in New York, St. Paul, and elsewhere that ended with arrests, Anchorage's peaceful gathering focused on the positive relationship between police and the community. Alaska Public Media's Anne Hillman was there.
The diverse crowd waved signs reading "Justice for All" and "You don't have to be black to be outraged." Community leaders were speaking at the corner of the parking lot on Northern Lights and the new Seward Highway. For 10 minutes, Nisha Jones recited the names of black victims of police shootings.
Josiah Williams.
Say my name.
Isaiah Corr.
Say my name.
Roger Prince.
The Washington Post, which has been tracking fatal shootings by police, reports that unarmed black men are 7 times as likely to be killed by police gunfire than unarmed white men. But Jones reminded the crowd that not all cops are bad. And in Anchorage, the police and the black community have a good relationship.
There is no blue wall here. There is no them against us. We live in a city of diversity, and I am thankful for that.
Police Chief Christopher Tolley read a prepared statement thanking the community for supporting each other during the country's difficult times.
We are all each other's neighbors, and we will always treat each other with compassion and respect.
The event was organized over Facebook by three Anchorage women, Annalisa Jacobs, Jasmine Smith, and Brittany Watkins. They say they didn't expect the massive turnout, but their post had hundreds of shares within 24 hours. Watkins says the Thursday shooting in Dallas targeting police officers made organizers in Anchorage nervous because they wanted a peaceful event, not something that led to the loss of more innocent lives.
I want to let people know that Black Lives Matter does not mean that no one else matters. We're coming together in unity, but we're just saying right now we're hurt. It's like when you have a broken leg. That broken leg is hurt. You don't worry about the other bones. You focus on that leg until it's healed. And then the rest of the body kind of works in motion. And that's what we wanted everyone to know.
The event started with somber reminders of police violence against African Americans, then took on a joyous mood as the crowd lined the sidewalks, cheering and waving signs as passing cars honked in support. Pastor Yolande Caravine of Anchorage said the police shootings broke her heart, and people need to realize that not every officer is bad, just as not every person is bad.
When we bleed, we all going to bleed the same color blood, so we need to come together and love one another and stop all this hate and this vindictive evil spirit, because that is not how God wants us to be.
Over the weekend, the Anchorage Police Department sent out a local alert message. Usually they're used to relay information about a crime or a traffic accident, but this time, the police thanked the community for the outpouring of support they've received. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Your freezer breaks and you need a part. You could go to the store or online, or you could go to the landfill. And that's what people in Bethel have done for decades, salvaging and reusing what other people have thrown away. Now, the city is saying no more. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
There's a pile of copper sitting right there that's got to be cut up, put into totes, and then back, and you can see there's a pile of aluminum there.
Tom McColson.
Bethel resident and landfill scavenger.
Well, this is big stuff here. Flanges, stuff out of big buildings. Anytime they renovate a building, they cut all this stuff out and throw it away. So it goes into the dump in mass piles.
McCulson lives off the Bethel grid, a property scattered with old vehicles, machines, and piles of metal. There are multiple workshops, a kiln for melting and casting metal, and that roar in the background, that's a generator from a combo solar and wind power source McCulson built himself. He's used to building his own things, and the landfill has always been a ready source of materials.
We joke as we drive by that it's the store, that's where people go to shop.
Or it was. At the beginning of June, Bethel City Manager Ann Capello wrote a memo.
My direction was that no one can remove any city property. Once something is deposited in the landfill, it becomes city property.
And city property, Capella says, has a specific way of being disposed of under city law. Anything under $5,000 has to be sold at public auction. Anything over that amount has to get approval from city council to be sold. Just taking things at will isn't an option. Capella also sees a larger issue with people scrounging in the landfill.
There are a lot of hazardous materials on there. There are iron sticking out, there is sharp objects, there's broken glass.
Capella sees all that risk creating liability for the city. But stuff from the Bethel landfill shows up everywhere. People strip parts for vehicles, they take wood for heating or to build fish camps. Right now, it's popular for people to take broken concrete blocks to weigh down fish nets.
Do you know of anyone who's gotten hurt salvaging out here?
Negative. If they have, they haven't complained to the city about it.
David Stovner is the Bethel Landfill Manager.
It's always been our policy up here to let people salvage stuff, as long as they're not being stupid about it.
About these people who've come up and tried to salvage, what do you say to them?
Say it's been cut off. If you take it, you're stealing from the city.
And then what do they say to that?
They said, that's stupid. We've always done this.
Then what do you do? I mean, you can't, I imagine you don't like physically bar them.
No, I tell them that you just can't do it.
And do they do it anyway or do they leave?
For the most part, people respect that and turn around and leave. I'm sure there's some people that still take stuff, but, you know, I'm one person up here.
Which means a lot of time, no one's watching. But Stovner says that doesn't mean people aren't there.
It's been traditional. People will sneak in over the berm, or you can go round the gate, you know. It's not Fort Knox by any means.
There's only a chain link fence and no cameras between an old Bethel tradition and this new enforcement. Stovner says he's had to turn away almost 100 people so far. But in the morning, when he gets to work, he sees tracks. City Manager Capella says the city council will have to change the law to change her position. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Scientists are trying to determine whether recent whale strandings in Alaska are related to a die-off here last year. While there are some clues, Alaska Public Media's Graylin Brashear reports it's a difficult mystery to solve.
Marine researchers were hoping that 2016 was going to be a better year for whales in Alaska.
We're kind of thinking that was over, and then just these last couple of weeks, things have really picked up.
Kathy Burrick is a veterinary pathologist who does postmortems on dead whales, and she's been very busy this past year. In 2015, 45 large whales were found dead in the Gulf of Alaska alone, more than five times higher than average. A spike this big is called an unusual mortality event, or UME, and NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service works with researchers like Burek to determine the cause. Getting to the bottom of the mystery is proving difficult, in part because it looks like this wave of deaths may not be over. Nearly 20 whales have been found dead in the region this year. At least 4 of those were found in the last 2 weeks. Investigators try to learn as much as they can about each dead whale. But Burek says getting tissue samples to study can be tricky.
So many places in Alaska are so remote, you know, it's just very hard to get to them.
They also have to deal with hungry bears beating them to carcasses and extreme tides that can wash the whales away.
Even if you get to a whale, it's a lot of work to get down to bone like skull and spine in order to be able to really say for sure it wasn't struck by a ship or there wasn't trauma. Last year, even with all those whales, we actually didn't get to a single whale to do a full workup.
So there's a dearth of data for NOAA's team of experts to analyze to try to figure out what caused all those deaths. They've had better luck getting samples from some of the whales that have died this year, but it's not clear if this year's deaths are related to last year's or if it's a new problem altogether. So do we know anything at this point about what's been killing whales? Sort of.
Our biggest, most promising hypothesis right now that it's related to the increase in harmful algal bloom toxins.
Specifically, domoic acid and saxitoxin. They're produced by certain species of algae, which are showing up in higher concentrations in northern waters in recent years. In 2015, unusually warm waters contributed to a record algae bloom in the Pacific that produced a lot of domoic acid, which has been linked to sea lion and bird die-offs. But Burek says, we don't know if these toxins are directly responsible for the whale deaths.
And all kinds of animals all over the place in Alaska, many more places than we thought. You know, we are picking up domoic acid and saxitoxin in most of the marine mammal species that we've been looking at. And, you know, a lot of them died of something else, even trauma. So if an animal dies of trauma, it has saxitoxin in its system, saxitoxin or domoic acid, was it compromised from the toxin and more likely to be killed? And it's very hard to really pin down what's different or what's changing.
Burek says we'll have to wait at least a few more months before we know more about the possible cause of deaths of whales in Alaska waters this year. But she says the bigger questions of how a changing ocean ecosystem is contributing to these die-offs are even harder to answer. In Anchorage, I'm Graylin Brashear.
Alaska is a paleontological candy store. Those are the words of Texas-based scientist Anthony Ferrillo. He spent the last 19 years studying dinosaurs in Alaska. Before he left for this season's field research, he spoke to APRN's Lori Townsend, saying, "Our state is so exciting to research because although the first fossils were found in 1961, the big work didn't start until the mid-80s.
So it's very, very new. And now that more people are looking, there's just a tremendous amount of opportunity here. And that's what prompted me to think of a candy store. And it's, you know, somebody gave me the keys and it's been a great ride."
What are the more unique discoveries in Alaska?
Boy, that's a tough one. In that I would almost feel like every one of the discoveries is unique. The idea that we're finding new animals isn't really that surprising. You could almost predict it, because we are so far away from where anything else had been found. And just by virtue of that, you think geographically, you could make a prediction that I'll bet there's going to be some new material here. And in some cases, that's been the case. There are other dinosaurs that are found in the lower 48, and that's okay. And so there are some dinosaurs like Troodon, for example, which is a small meat-eating dinosaur. You find it in abundance on the North Slope, but you can go to West Texas and find it as well. But then there are some unique dinosaurs like this pygmy tyrannosaur, Nanuxaurus. And then the horned dinosaur is unique. Pachyrhinosaurus peroorum are two examples of unique dinosaurs to Alaska.
What's on your agenda for this summer? Where are you heading and what are you looking for?
We're going from King Salmon out to Aniakchak National Monument, where we'll spend the next couple of weeks looking at rocks that we think are about the same age as the rocks we've been working on in Denali and the rocks that we were working on along the Colville River. And that age is about 70 million years. I worked this area about 2001, 2002. And this was a park that intrigued me for a number of reasons. And literally in the last 2 hours of that expedition, I looked on the ground and there was a hadrosaur footprint and two handprints. And it was the first time anything like that had been found. And I was giddy and speechless and grabbed everybody to make sure that they saw this in case, you know, something happened to me. This was like the most important thing I think had ever been found in all of human history. At least that's what I thought. So I made sure that somebody knew about this thing. And that was the first record of a dinosaur from southwestern Alaska for this age. And what was nice about that is it launched a lot of enthusiasm in the Park Service, the region, so that other parks then opened their doors for me to come and look. And now we've had this great success in Yukon Charlie and Wrangell St. Elias, but most spectacularly is Denali, which for the last 10, 11, 12 years, we have found dinosaurs like it's nobody's business. And so what we're doing in Aniakchak is trying to extend, first, we want to confirm that these rocks are the same age. And from that, we want to go into this area with this newly informed sense of what the ecosystem looked like and see if we can't extend that transect all the way from northern Alaska to southern Alaska and look at things across a really large region to understand what is determining biodiversity and ecosystem dynamics and things like that. And so it could be pretty exciting stuff.
Anthony Fiorillo is a paleontologist and vice president of research and collections and chief curator at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Graylin Brashear and Lori Townsend in Anchorage, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Ann Hillman produced tonight's show. Our web editor is Wesley Early, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.